All right, let's jump into another deep dive. Today, we're going back in time, way back to 1921.
Oh, this is going to be good.
It is. We're looking at a case. Well, you gave us a brief on it. Carroll v. United States.
I'm familiar with it.
It all goes down during Prohibition. Two guys, Carroll and Kiro.
Suspected bootleggers.
Exactly. And they're driving down a highway.
I can see where this is going.
The feds, they search their car. But here's the question. Did they have a warrant?
Ah, the Fourth Amendment comes into play.
Get it. That's exactly what this case grapples with.
The classic case. It boils down to that constant tension, you know, individual privacy versus effective law enforcement.
The balancing act, right?
Exactly. Trying to find that sweet spot.
So the brief lays it all out, starting with those federal agents. They're trying to buy whiskey from Carroll and Kiro.
Undercover operation.
Yeah, but the deal falls through.
Okay, so that's suspicious, but not enough, right?
Not at all. But then the agents, they keep seeing these guys driving around, always coming from Detroit.
Detroit. That's like bootlegger central back then.
Right, a known liquor hub. So suspicion's building.
But suspicion and probable cause, two very different things.
For sure. And this wasn't just a quick glance in the window.
Oh, no, I bet it wasn't.
The brief says they tore the car apart, ripping up upholstery, and boom, hidden whiskey and gin.
68 bottles. No wonder this case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Huge constitutional question at stake. Does the Fourth Amendment, protecting against unreasonable searches and seizures, does that apply to cars the same way it does to homes?
Big question. Huge implications.
And majority opinion, written by Chief Justice Taft, argued vehicles are different. They're mobile.
Makes sense. If officers had to get a warrant every time.
Yeah, the car would be long gone.
Poof. Gone with the evidence.
Exactly. But Taft didn't stop there. He dug into history way back.
Oh, I love when they do that.
Right. He looked at early American laws about searching ships for smuggled goods.
Interesting. Trying to find those historical parallels.
And he used those precedents to say, treating vehicles differently, that's not a new idea. It's rooted in legal tradition.
So it's not just a Prohibition era quirk.
Not at all. Goes all the way back. Fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. It's about understanding those historical roots.
But Taft was also clear. This automobile exception, it's not a free-for-all. Officers still need probable cause.
The million-dollar question, what constitutes probable cause?
Right. So what does that mean when you're talking about a vehicle?
It's not just a hunch. It has to be based on facts, what a reasonable person would believe.
So more than just a feeling.
Much more. It's about those concrete facts known to the officer at the time.
Like if you saw someone running out of a bank, a bag of cash, ski mask on, you'd probably think, something's not right here.
Exactly. That's a pretty good example of probable cause.
That's objective. Got to have a good reason. That's the heart of the Fourth Amendment.
Protecting against arbitrary searches. That's key.
Absolutely. But in this case, not everyone agreed on that probable cause. Justice McReynolds, he had a different view.
Oh, yeah. McReynolds, he was not on board.
He wrote a concurring opinion. Yeah. He basically said the arrest itself, it was illegal.
Because he felt they didn't have probable cause.
Right. He saw it as a government overreach, straight up.
That's a big accusation, overreach.
McReynolds was really worried about potential abuse. And this quote from him, I love it. He said, "The damnable character of the bootlegger's business should not close our eyes to the mischief which will surely follow any attempt to destroy it by unwarranted methods."
Powerful words. Still relevant today.
Absolutely. That debate, individual rights versus effective law enforcement, it's a constant struggle.
It never really goes away.
And that automobile exception established in Carroll, it's still debated today.
Still causing a stir.
What is probable cause during a traffic stop?
It's a question courts are still figuring out.
Where's the line between a hunch and reasonable suspicion?
It's a blurry line sometimes.
This case, it opened a whole can of worms, and we're still dealing with them today.
Definitely a lot to unpack.
And that's what makes these deep dives so fascinating, right?
Absolutely.
Peeling back the layers of history, legal precedent, and seeing how they shape our world today.
It's all connected.
We're just getting started with Carroll v. United States. We'll be back to dive deeper into this landmark case and its lasting impact.
Can't wait to keep exploring.
It seems like with this probable cause thing, there's a lot of gray area.
Oh, for sure, especially with vehicles.
So how do courts actually decide? Like, did an officer have enough to justify a search?
Yeah, you hit it, probable cause, it's essential, but not always black and white.
Not like a checklist, right?
Nope, no checklist. The courts look at the totality of the circumstances.
I mean,
it's everything, all the facts, the context, not just one little detail.
So not just what the officer sees or smells right then and there.
Right. Think back to Carroll and Kiro.
Okay. Back to our bootleggers.
The agents, they'd been trying to buy from them for months.
Oh, right, that whole undercover thing.
They knew these guys were driving from Detroit, a known source of illegal booze.
So it wasn't random, it was a pattern.
Exactly. That pattern, it all feeds into the totality.
The agents were piecing it together, building a case.
And that's what the court focused on, that prior knowledge, seeing them driving from Detroit again.
Enough to reasonably believe they had contraband.
That's the key, reasonable belief.
But what about Justice McReynolds? He wasn't convinced.
McReynolds, always a stickler, he was worried about overreach.
Like we were saying earlier.
His warnings matter, even today, but the majority, they felt this case. It met the standard.
It wasn't just a hunch. There was real evidence.
Enough to justify the search based on everything they knew.
So this automobile exception, it exists, but it's not a blank check for the cops.
No, there are limits, checks and balances, gotta protect those rights.
That's good to hear. The Fourth Amendment still matters, even with a car.
Always. And remember, a defendant can challenge a search.
Oh, right, if they think their rights were violated.
They can fight back, maybe get the evidence thrown out.
So it's not a done deal just because it's a car.
Nope, the courts look closely, gotta make sure everything was legit.
Makes you think, this whole automobile exception, is it still relevant? I mean, think about technology today.
Oh, that's a big one. The world's changed a lot since 1925.
Cars now, they're like computers on wheels collecting data left and right.
GPS, sensors, the whole nine yards.
And all that data, it could be used in investigations.
Which raises some tricky legal questions.
Is our car really private anymore? Like, if it's snitching on us?
That's the debate raging right now. How does the Fourth Amendment apply to all this new tech?
It's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, those old rules.
They weren't designed for this. GPS tracking, smartphones, it's a whole new ball game.
Do we need new laws then, specific to all this data stuff?
Some experts say yes. Can't just rely on old cases like Carroll.
Because those old frameworks, they didn't anticipate this data explosion.
Right, and some worry that could leave our digital privacy vulnerable.
This is making me nervous, like we're in this legal limbo.
It's true, the old rules don't quite fit, but the new ones aren't clear yet.
So what can we do? How do we protect ourselves in this mess?
Another great question, one that needs a whole deep dive itself.
We might need to do that.
But think of your digital footprint like a car, okay?
Okay, I'm visualizing my data as a car.
You wouldn't leave it unlocked, valuables in plain sight, would you?
No way. That's asking for trouble.
Same with your digital life. Be mindful what you share, your privacy settings.
So being proactive, controlling what's out there.
Exactly. You have more power than you think. But let's get back to Carroll for a sec.
Okay, back to the historical stuff.
You mentioned Taft looked at early American laws, right?
Yeah, he went way back.
What kind of laws was he digging into?
Well, he was looking at how they treated searches of ships. Turns out they treated ships differently from homes.
Ah, interesting. Like different rules for different places.
Back then, smuggling was huge.
Makes sense. Gotta enforce those import laws.
So ships were basically the 18th century cars.
Kind of, yeah. Moving goods, prime targets for searches.
And get this, even the first Congress, they had laws about it.
They were on top of this stuff.
They allowed searches of ships without a warrant.
Really? No warrant at all?
If they had reason to suspect smuggle goods, sounds familiar, right?
Wow. So this idea of vehicles being different, it goes way back.
Taft wasn't making it up. It's been around forever.
Even in 1815, there's a law they could stop and search any vehicle, beast, or person.
Wait, beast, like a donkey carrying contraband.
Exactly. If they thought it was smuggled goods, they could search.
Wild. Times have changed, thankfully.
For sure, but the point is, this shows a pattern, how they treated moving things differently.
Ships, wagons, people carrying stuff, it was different from a house.
A house was fixed, these things were mobile, that was the key.
So Taft, he's using all this history to back up the automobile exception.
He's saying the founding fathers, they understood this difference.
Homes and vehicles, separate categories when it comes to searches.
In that historical context, it was crucial to his argument.
It's fascinating how he connected those dots.
He believed the framers knew, sometimes you need warrantless searches.
Especially with vehicles, they can disappear so fast.
Gone in 60 seconds, along with the evidence.
Exactly. If officers always needed a warrant, it'd be impossible.
Especially with something like bootlegging. Speed is everything.
They'd never catch anyone.
So that's why the court upheld the search in Carroll.
Setting that precedent we still follow today.
That's how it works, building on the past.
I never realized how much history was behind all this.
It's all connected. Even routine traffic stops have this deep backstory.
This deep dive has been eye-opening for sure.
It's amazing what you find when you start digging.
And we're not done yet. We'll be back to explore even more about Carroll v. United States and its impact on our world today.
Looking forward to it.
It's wild to think a case from the Prohibition era still relevant today.
It really is. Shows how those legal principles, they stick around.
Even as the world changes like crazy, right?
Exactly. And that's what makes studying law so cool. Not just rules, but the ideas behind them.
And how those ideas apply to, like, everything new that pops up.
All those new situations. Gotta figure out how the law fits.
But with all this talk about digital privacy and those old rules not quite working with new tech.
Yeah, that's a big one.
What can we actually do to protect ourselves?
So the million-dollar question, and honestly, we could do a whole deep dive just on that.
Oh, we should add that to the list.
But for now, a few starting points. Be mindful what you share online.
Like, think before you post.
Exactly. And check those privacy settings. Social media is a wild west out there.
So being proactive, taking control of our digital footprint, all that.
Exactly. You wouldn't leave your front door wide open, would you?
Nope. Not unless I'm moving out.
Your online presence, it's kind of the same. Gotta be smart about it.
That's a good way to put it. Makes it much easier to grasp.
But I know what you're thinking. What about all the data that's already out there?
It's like, is it even possible to control it at this point?
True. Completely erasing your digital footprint. Almost impossible these days.
Ugh, it's a bummer.
But you can control what you add to it going forward.
Okay, so damage control.
Kinda. Pay attention to those apps you download, websites you visit, all those permissions.
So being more careful, more aware of the trails we leave behind.
Right, like driving, you wouldn't speed through a school zone, would you?
Nope. That's a recipe for disaster.
Same online. Know the rules of the road. Make good choices.
Makes sense. Digital traffic laws.
Exactly. It's easy to feel overwhelmed, but you're right. Knowledge is power.
The more we know about our data, the better we can protect it.
Couldn't agree more. And there are tons of resources out there.
Oh, like what?
Groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, ACLU, they're great.
I'll have to check those out.
They've got info on digital rights, privacy issues, all that good stuff.
Awesome. Thanks for the tip. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can do a whole deep dive on digital privacy later.
Definitely worth exploring. But for now, let's wrap up, Carroll.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground today.
We did, from bootleggers and whiskey all the way to the digital age.
It's amazing how a case from 1925 is still relevant today.
It shows the power of the law, how it adapts.
But also how important it is to understand those core principles.
Yep.
Like probable cause, the Fourth Amendment, all that.
You can be part of that adaptation, you know?
Not just passive bystanders.
Exactly. The law is always changing. Got to keep up.
This deep dive has been a wild ride. Thanks for taking us through it.
My pleasure. Always a good time to geek out about legal history.
And for everyone listening, keep those questions coming.
Stay curious, stay informed. Maybe one of you will argue the next big privacy case.
Now that's a thought. Well, on that note, time to wrap up this deep dive.
Until next time.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here soon for another deep dive into the fascinating world of law and history.